Southwestern University, in cooperation with the Mutual Broadcasting System, presents The Reviewing Stand.
Northwestern University is celebrating its centennial year, 100 years of service to the nation and the great Northwest.
Today, The Reviewing Stand asks, what are other nations saying about us? Our unrehearsed give-and-take discussion will center around European attitudes toward America and ways to better understanding. Now our moderator, James H. McBurney, Dean of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, will introduce participants in today's discussion. Mr. McBurney.
Our speakers today are François Brier, Consul General of France, Dennis A.H. Wright, Acting British Consul General, and I should say that Mr. Wright is making his last public appearance in America. He returns to England as head of the Economic Relations Department of the Foreign Office very soon. And also Irving Flom, who is foreign editor of the Chicago Sun-Times and professor of journalism at Northwestern University. Now, tell us, do the people of Europe have fairly accurate conceptions of the United States, do you think?
There has always, Mr. McBurney, there has always been among the democratic nations of Europe, and particularly in France, a friendly feeling towards the United States because of their common faith in democratic principles. There is no doubt that the part played by the United States during and since the last World War has made Europe much more aware of the prominence of the United States in world affairs. Europeans do realize that no lasting peace can be attained without the active cooperation of your great democracy. However, I would say that the general public in France doesn't know very well the American life. It knows it by the film. And I encountered roughly two kinds of misconceptions, one of economic character and the other one of intellectual and moral character. In certain circles, it is feared that the foreign policy of the United States may take the aspect of economic imperialism. The people who are against capitalism express, whether sincerely or otherwise, the fear that Americans will gain control of Europe's concerns and European economy. It would be very much desirable that the general public be better acquainted with the mechanism of Marshall Plan, which has contributed so much to France's recovery. Sometimes, man who has got a tractor from the American government under the Marshall Plan has paid for it in France, but he doesn't understand what has been done to the general economy of France by the plan. Now, in the intellectual field, cultured French people who show a tendency towards intellectual nationalism often do not have the proper understanding of American philosophy. They don't know it very well, and of American history. And they see only the material accomplishments of American civilization, which are so enormous, so obvious, and they express the fear that a civilization based largely on material progress might endanger the traditional culture of France.
Do your people share these views at all, Wright?
Well, there certainly are misconceptions along the lines mentioned by Brier. The man in the street, like the man in the street in America, suffers some enormous misconceptions about life in this country, largely, I think, due to the fact that he gets his ideas very largely from the Hollywood films, which are seen in all cinemas throughout the country. We tend to think, I think, of cowboys and millionaires and large automobiles and gangsters as being typical of American life. We don't know enough about the vastness of America, the enormous resources, the various climatic conditions you've got, the agricultural potentiality of this great country. But I would counter that by saying that as a result of the thousands of American soldiers who came over the last war, of the impact of martial aid, the impact of Americans in general on Europe and on Britain, and of course of tourists, the visit to this country of productivity teams from Britain, we have become much more aware of America in Britain today than ever before in our history, I should say.
I take it from what these two gentlemen have been saying that the propaganda program of the United States government, the Voice of America, the films and the lecturers and whatnot, is not doing a very good job, or at least not doing a fast enough job, that the people still do not understand about the size of our country and the way our people live. Is that correct?
Well, of course, I haven't lived very much in England the last few years, but I should say that you're devoting your propaganda program primary to countries which you feel need it. It's a compliment to us, perhaps, that you don't embark on it so forcefully in our countries.
Is there any substantial anti-American sentiment in England, right?
I wouldn't call it substantial. It is certainly nothing like as substantial as the, say, anti-British feeling I've found in this part of the world in the last 2.5 years I've been here.
I know there is a lot of anti-British feeling that you can hear and see, but isn't it true that it's also not very substantial? Because we have been helping the British and on the side of Britain in every controversy, so the anti-British sentiment has not had a very substantial effect.
That's quite true. I would certainly agree on that. But the fact remains that there is a substantial criticism, vocal, right at the highest level in this country, which is not so in Britain. But I say, we'll start off by saying that we have got in England a minority group of the Labour Party, which you have heard much about in the last few months, led by Mr. Bevan, who resigned from the Cabinet, very largely on the score of criticism of American policy. I should like to emphasize that it is a minority group. It is not important in our political life at the moment, but it is a group which is vocal, which has got certain two periodicals, weekly periodicals, which express their views.
Well, what do they say?
Well, I can quote from one of them last week's editorial in the New Statesman and Nation, which I think is typical of this left-wing minority group. It's not a communist group, Marco. Let me quote. Ever since last January, when the defense program was so dramatically enlarged in order to satisfy American requirements, we have been steadily losing the independence of action that we had achieved by making ourselves independent of martial aid. An arms program which makes havoc of our export drive and vast inroads on our dollar reserves is bound to have this effect first on our economy and then on our foreign policy as well.
I notice in that statement that you just read from this magazine, which does represent a leftist view and a rather small group in England, they are talking about the American program and the American drive for armaments and so on. And does that mean that Europeans consider the defense of Europe an American job and an American business, and that holding back communism is entirely our affair and not yours?
Most certainly not, I think.
Well, then why are we being criticized? Do our aims differ, or is it a difference in tactics, or is it something else that you suspect our aims, that you don't think we're interested in defense, but interested in offense, in attacking?
Well, I think this minority group, which can best be explained by saying that a few years ago, the New Statesman Nation was bitterly critical of the British government on the score that it was imperialistic. It now argues that Britain is no longer imperialistic, but America is, and therefore criticizes America.
I mean, in other words, there must be some devil in the picture, and yeah, now we're it.
Maybe, yes.
Well, do you find any such views expressed in France, Breer?
I think that, on the whole, the French people are very sensible, and they understand perfectly well that there are certain requirements for the common defense. But we have some material difficulties, lodging conditions are difficult, we have not rebuilt enough, and we have not built enough since the war. The housing problem is very hard. So I think that the American authorities in implementing the program in France should be extremely careful, and they should act with the greatest tact, not to antagonize in any manner the population of France. You know, the French people are Latin people, they are a little irritable, but that's only very small fractions.
You're referring, I suppose, to the possibility of American officers and soldiers, as we say, throwing their weight around and insulting people and acting as if they ran the country instead of were guests. Is that what you're thinking of?
Yes, I think that's a question of tact, that's a question of friendliness, and certainly the French people have not forgotten what they owe to the American soldiers in the liberation of France, and they will be ready.
Do both of you agree that our soldiers in the last war did more good than harm in the way of building up a friendly attitude toward our country?
I should most certainly say they have.
You think so?
No, good ambassadors, yes. For you.
Yes, certainly.
Would you go so far as to say that there are segments of your people that fear America?
No, I don't think there's any what I call fear in the sense that we feared Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia today. Quite the reverse. I mean, we regard America as one of our greatest and best friends. But there are certain things which you might say are fears, which I think are worth mentioning now. We fear, I think, that you may be trying to drive us a bit too fast in building up this common bulwark against Soviet Russia. Again, we sometimes fear that you don't appreciate all the ancient histories and, say, traditions, animosities, which still tend to divide European countries and make it, in our view, not so easy to form a federal, single economic unit, politically as well, in Europe today. And then, I think we fear that in your anxiety to build up this anti-communist front, you don't appreciate the economic conditions under which we in Europe must exist if we are going to survive and retain our standards of living. England, which is typical of other countries, has to import foodstuffs and raw materials. There's no getting away from that. We are a small island and we can't grow everything we want. Now, to do this, we have either got to go to America or to Canada, which means spending dollars, of which we are very short, and as you well know, or we have got to go to our traditional sources, which happen to be, in many cases, behind the Iron Curtain, say, lumber from Russia, cereals from Russia, and so on. Now, if you are going to insist that we can only trade certain articles with the Russians against the goods we need, we are going to find ourselves in an awfully difficult position, and we are not yet at war. If, on the other hand, you do insist, we would like to think that we would have a far greater opportunity of selling our goods in this country. At the moment, it's difficult. You have high tariff walls. You've helped us enormously, we know, in the last few years to sell more goods in this country, but not enough to make us independent of these other historic and vital sources of supply.
Of course, in a certain sense, those tariff walls are designed to give us some protection, too.
Of course they are, just as I think that any young country must build up tariff walls in its early stages. But remember that in Britain, in the great days of 19th century, we had no tariff walls at all. We were pumping sterling out into the world, and that is what we feel you are not at this moment prepared to do.
Well, we're pumping it out through the Marshall Plan and other aid programs.
Yes,
but you're thinking now of other days, of the future, when these programs won't be in effect.
Yes, that's right.
Let me go back just a little, if I may, Briere. I'd like to know how your people feel about American participation in World Wars I and II. We have the report here that there is some feeling that we came pretty late. Now, is that a general feeling in France?
Oh, yes, McBurney, that's a very strong feeling in France. It has been felt in my country that an enormous loss of men and resources in these two wars could have been prevented by an earlier intervention of the United States on the side of the countries fighting for the defense of liberty. Many Frenchmen even think that these wars might have been shortened or averted by an early decision of your nation.
Which, of course, leads me to inquire about your present fear that we're moving too fast. Apparently, in World Wars I and II, we were too slow, and now we're too fast.
Well, there's a difference. One was the war in which we were actually fighting and losing valuable lives, and this is a war which hasn't begun and which we hope will not begin. I mean, we do not assume that there's going to be a war with Russia tomorrow or in 10 years' time, even.
I just want to add one word, and that the Americans are accused of being late, of course, but so are the British accused of being late on the continent. And when the country is occupied, anybody who gets there before the before it's in time to save the country from occupation is, of course, late. But Britain is not being accused of being over-anxious. That's the difference.
Well, I think in answer to that, Tom, I can say that in both 1914 and 1939 war, we were on French soil within 24 hours of the outbreak of war.
Correct, but not on there with enough.
Maybe.
Well, how do you feel about the Atlantic Pact and this system of defense being organized in Western Europe, Briere?
I think that it is the evidence of the significant change of policy of the United States and of the public opinion in this country in the last war. It is a pity that the Security Council of the United Nations, on which I served for some time, has not been able to
really maintain peace. But in view of the obvious failure of the Security Council, the French people have certainly welcomed the Atlantic Pact, with the exception, of course, of those who are inclined to follow the Moscow doctrines. As far as the system of defense is concerned, the French people are ready to take part in it. They were very pleased with the appointment of General Eisenhower as the head of the European defense system, and by the fact that the great American general has asked our General Juin to be the chief of the ground forces for Central Europe. But they will have no sense of security. You know that we are always irritating the people about this question of security. We always speak of security, but we are so near to the danger. To the
well, I would
danger,
think with considerable yes. reason.
Yes. That if that system is not intended to efficiently assure the protection of the territory, the system will not work. And not only of our territory, but of the territory of the other members of the Atlantic Pact. And the French authorities have already taken part in that system of defense by a three-year plan, aiming at training and equipping a continental army of 20 divisions. And you should remember that one-third of our budget is devoted to rearmament, which is an enormous burden for a country like France, which has only 40 million of people and which has limited resources.
I would completely agree with what Breyer has said. We welcome the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. We feel that it does mean that America will be with us right from the beginning, so to speak, and that, as we see it, your security is tied up very, very closely with our own. And we too, of course, have gone ahead with a rearmament program which is disrupting our own sort of standards of living. We've been on an austerity program ever since 1939, and it's pretty hard on the people. Suddenly, when it looked as if they were, the light were coming through, to be told that they've got to go back onto this same sort of program and sacrifice better days of easier living.
I would think so very much.
Well, now, as I hear from these two gentlemen, you agree with the Atlantic Pact, of course. You agree with the system of defense for Western Europe. But then American generals and admirals come along and decide that the Atlantic Pact and the system of defense for Western Europe requires bases in Spain. And then they go ahead and get these bases, or proceed to get them. And the French and British governments and other governments say, we don't want these bases. We don't like that system. We don't agree with what you're doing. Now, what's the trouble there? Why, how can you agree with our defense and our general program and our treaty and yet disagree with what we do?
Yes, I can say definitely that a great part of French public opinion, as well as the French government, are definitely opposed to these agreements.
With Spain, you mean?
Yes, with Spain, because they consider that it is first a problem of great moral importance, and that it is not possible to integrate the Franco regime in the Western Alliance, which is based on the solidarity of the democracies. Furthermore, the French people are of the opinion that, militarily speaking, such agreements would not bring any substantial contributions to the Western defense.
Well, I can say that my own government's views are very close to those of the French. I can't do better, perhaps, than quote from a statement made by Mr. Ernest Davis, who's Parliamentary Undersecretary for Foreign Affairs, in the House of Commons on 25th of July. He said this: "It is the view of His Majesty's government that the strategic advantages of establishing any closer association between Spain and the West are outweighed by the effects which such an association would have on the morale of the other members of the Western community."
Well, now, apart from the moral question, which both of you gentlemen raised, might not Spain be of very real strategic value, Flan?
Well, apparently our general staff believes it is. Otherwise, I can't understand why we would go ahead without consulting the British and French and other members of NATO, or going ahead against their advice. They must consider it extremely important, and I think they must have in mind a place to go to in case they are defeated in the rest of Western Europe and they have to retreat from France and Germany to some other place. They want to have this place ready. Now, of course, the French can't consider that possibility, but the American command must.
I should say, Brown, that we don't think in terms of retreat at all, and we think first in terms of defense of the territory, because it is extremely important in the minds of the French people that our territory should be defended and not liberated later, because we have suffered so much from...
Would you say, Breer, then, that our action in Madrid, that is going ahead now with the late Admiral Sherman negotiating with Franco, would that create in the minds of Frenchmen some doubt and fear and suspicion that maybe the Americans or maybe France will not be defended? Maybe it can't be defended, and maybe that's why the Americans are out after bases in Spain. Does that sort of thinking go on in the minds of French people, would you say?
I don't know it would be absolutely the case, because I think that this question should be examined from a moral and political point of view. But anything anything which would be of a nature to undermine the morale of the countries who are going to build the defenses of Europe is certainly not very good.
Yes, but there's just one more point I want to make. Both you and Wright made this point in what you said about Spain. You said you didn't, your countries didn't believe that the military value of bases in Spain was great enough to justify what we're doing. Now, military value must mean that you don't agree with our general staff about the need and necessity for those bases. Now, where does that disagreement come?
I honestly don't know, because I'm not a soldier and I'm not aware of any of the technical arguments one way or the other, but we do apparently feel very strongly on this, both on the strategic side and on the political and moral side, and I don't think it would be safe for me to argue further, but I just don't know.
That's why I suggested it might be this question of a retreat, where your military staff would say, we're not going to consider the possibility of retreat, and our military staff would say, well, we must consider the possibility of retreat, and that's where Spain comes in.
Yes, I think that all those matters, as we saw in this little discussion, can be considered from political and military points of view, and it proves to me that it is absolutely necessary to have consultations and agreements with the governments concerned before taking any decision on those points.
In this case, there was no agreement or consultation?
I'm afraid not much.
How do your people regard, right, these American installations in England? And I would be glad to have your opinion, Breer, too, on American installations in France. It would seem to me that might create some delicate situation.
You're talking now about military bases?
Military bases in your own
airfields.
Well, I've just come back from 3 months over in England, have traveled over most of the country, and came across a lot of American soldiers, airmen. I found no criticism among the people of their behavior or feeling that we are now being occupied by the American forces. As I said earlier, I think we've got to be awfully careful that as more of your men come in, as presumably they will do, that they continue to be as tactful as they are at present. But certainly from the more official point of view, we welcome their presence there. It gives us a sense of security, a sense of that you are with us right from the beginning, as I said earlier.
I was going to add, right, that gives you a sense of security. Also, it gives you a certain fear that if our leadership goes haywire, as we say, and gets into a war too quickly or gets into a dangerous situation too quickly and unnecessarily, then the American bases will attract enemy, will be targets for the enemy and will attract enemy bombs, and then England and France and all the other countries where there are bases will be thrown into the middle of a terrible air war, and hence these bases, while they make you feel secure, also make you feel insecure.
Well, there is that feeling, but I think that's a very sort of small minority feeling, which I hadn't thought worthwhile bringing out at this point, because it's not the general feeling at all. I mean, if there is going to be a war, which is presumably going to be started by the other side, if at all, we're going to be in it sooner or later, and in many ways, the sooner the better.
Are British and French attitudes toward America essentially the same, would you say, gentlemen, as those in other European countries as you know them? We've been talking, we have representatives of France and and Britain here. How about the other European countries? Our subject today is, what are other nations saying about us?
Well, of course, I can't speak for other countries. England, Mr. Wright here, certainly wouldn't say that he could speak for all the nations in the British Commonwealth of Nations, would you, Mr. Wright? You couldn't speak for India. France certainly can't speak for Europe, not even for Western Europe. The voice of France isn't the voice of Germany, not yet at any rate. And so, within the limitations of time, I'll try to speak for other countries, but you realize the difficulties, I'm sure. I can only give you an idea by quoting from certain people. Now, I have a statement here by my colleague Frederick Koo, who was a longtime correspondent in Europe, and another statement from Dorothy Thompson, a syndicated columnist. Now, here's what Mr. Koo reports about the thoughts of other countries concerning the United States. And this is a very general statement, but I'm quoting now what he said. In the eyes of our European friends, our policy of creating positions of strength saddles them with a vast rearmament burden, threatens them with inflation, drives them into partnership with strange and dangerous bedfellows, and referring there, I suppose, to Franco, and leaves them directly under the gun of any Russian attack. What they object to is annihilation without representation. And I think that's definitely underlying most of the criticism of the United States, that the countries we're dealing with, some of the larger countries anyway, resent being pushed into a situation without having had adequate representation.
Of course, that seems to put us in the anomalous position, Plum, of being damned if we do and damned if we don't.
I'm afraid it does. If we go ahead with what we consider necessary against their advice and against their wishes, then, of course, we're going to be criticized. Now, Koo also goes on about the countries behind the Iron Curtain, for which nobody can speak at the moment. Our policy provokes an understandable alarm in Russian breasts. They see us ringing them with air bases stretching from Alaska, Japan, Formosa, and around the Arctic regions of Greenland, through Western Europe and into the Middle East. It is hardly surprising that this alarms the Russians. And then our relationship to Chiang Kai-shek is tarnishing Americans' reputation. And Koo concludes, we can't have it both ways. If we continue to play footsie with decaying reactionaries, we are bound to lose more and more friends among people intent upon breaking away from the dead past. In the few minutes left, may I just suggest what Dorothy Thompson said in a recent column. The greatest risk to the future of mankind is that the Soviet Union or the United States will undertake a preventive war out of the conviction that settlement is impossible and a showdown inevitable. From the American viewpoint, this danger appears to emanate entirely from the Russians. But in Russian eyes, the situation must appear otherwise. The avoidance of a major war requires more than formidable military strength. It requires, it requires the ability to gauge how far an opponent will allow himself to be goaded.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, but our time is up. You've been listening to the Northwestern University Reviewing Stand discussion, What Are Other Nations Saying About Us? Why not send now for a printed copy of this broadcast with a list of books and articles about the subject discussed. Copies may be purchased for 10 cents in coin. A subscription to the Reviewing Stand costs just $1 for the next 4 months, $2.50 for an entire year. Write to the Reviewing Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois. Our guests today were François Bruyère, Irving Plom, and Dennis A.H. Wright. Now our moderator, James H. McBurney, will tell you about next week's program.
Next week, the Reviewing Stand will consider a rather different sort of question, but I think an interesting one. How does color affect our lives? Our guests will be Lewis Cheskin, Technical Director of the Color Research Institute of America, Carl P. Duncan, Professor of Psychology at Northwestern University, and Colonel Alexis D. Sleknovsky, industrial designer for the American Electric Fusion Corporation. We invite you to listen next week for a discussion of the question, how does color affect our lives?
The Northwestern University Reviewing Stand is broadcast coast to coast every week as a public service feature of Mutual. Your announcer, Jerry Coffer. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.